This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 14th day of April 2011. And today I'm honored to be joined on the line by Jesse Trenadu, a former law professor with 30 years' experience as a trial lawyer, and the tragic torture and murder of his brother at a federal transfer center and the ongoing cover-up of that death has led him on a remarkable journey of discovery that has turned up bombshell information about what really happened to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. And more information on the case can be found at KennethTrenadue.com. That's T-R-E-N-T-A-D-U-E. Mr. Trenadue, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Jesse Trenadue, my longtime listeners will no doubt be somewhat familiar with the story of your brother and how it relates to the OKC bombing, and it's a story that I have referenced numerous times before on my podcast and in my videos, and that story generally begins with your brother's death. But before we get to that part of the story, I would like to take a moment to hear a bit about your brother and your relationship with him, because I think it's easy to forget that we are talking about a real human being here who really did lose his life for what it now appears was a case of mistaken identity. So can you flesh that out for us and tell us a little bit about your brother and the kind of person that he was?
Well, we grew up in a southern Appalachian coal camp and had the good fortune to be able to migrate to California in the early 1960s. Kenny was a very bright man, very popular. He, unfortunately, at that time is when the drug problems were starting to come onto the American scene. And he got into drug use. He enlisted in the Army, and like so many people during the Vietnam War, especially young men, came back as heroin addicts. He, to support his habit, he robbed a bank. He was caught. He confessed and pled guilty and went and did his time in jail. And he served his time. He married, had a little boy, and his son was only 2 months old when he was murdered. But my brother was we never condoned his bank robbery or anything like that, but he was a good person. He struggled with his addictions, and he overcame his addiction.
As I understand, when he was picked up and taken to the Oklahoma City Federal Correction Center, I understand that you were in touch with him even the day before that he was actually murdered.
Yes. He was picked up in San Diego. When he was released from prison, he had a probation officer that didn't approve of drinking. And my brother worked construction, and working construction, even if you don't work construction, people drink beer. And his probation officer put a no beer drinking condition on his parole. And my brother said, and I fought that. We went all through the administrative appeals on that and lost. And my brother basically said to his probation officer, he said, I'm going to drink beer. You know where I live. If you think that's enough to send me back to prison, come and get me. And of course they didn't. And he was out from about 1987 until 1995 after the Oklahoma City bombing. And suddenly he is picked up allegedly for a parole violation and sent to Oklahoma City for what we were told would be a parole violation hearing. He arrived there on a Friday night. I spoke with him Saturday evening. He was supposed to call back Sunday, and he arrived on Friday the 18th of August, 1995. I spoke to him on the 19th of August, the Saturday, for about 20 minutes, talking about his parole hearing and how that, there was no way they were going to send him back to jail for drinking beer. On Sunday, he was supposed to call me back, and he didn't. And on Monday morning, my mother received a call. This was August 21st, 1995, from the warden at the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City, saying my brother had committed suicide and asking permission to have his body cremated. And, of course, she refused. My mother refused that request. It took about a week of fighting with the federal government to have his body released. We found out later that during that time period, the federal government had made two attempts to have his body cremated. When he arrived home, he was covered in makeup, and my mother, his wife, and my sister removed the makeup. I was on my way to Southern California, in Orange County, where they'd sent the body, where his wife and my family still live. When I arrived, he had been beaten head to toe. His skull was split in three places. His throat had been cut. Even the soles of his feet had been beaten. And the government said it was a suicidal hanging. And what we never had was a motive for his death. People would say to you, why would the federal government torture, and he was tortured, and murder your brother? And we had no explanation for that. Another thing about the case that was always unexplainable was the fact that so much evidence disappeared. My brother was supposedly found with blood-stained clothing, but when his body was turned over to the medical examiner 2 hours later, his clothes are gone. He's wearing nothing but boxer shorts. The video camera, supposedly that would monitor access to my brother, malfunctioned. The logbooks that would have shown who came and went from the institution with access to my brother either disappeared, or the pages on the date my brother was there, dates my brother was there, were torn out. The crime scene photographs disappear. The medical examiner is not allowed access to the death scene. When he finally is allowed access to the death scene 4 months later, it had been painted and cleaned up. And this is all done by the FBI and the Department of Justice. And we could never understand why this kind of resistance was coming from the government.
Before we move on, so just to be clear, he was picked up for allegedly a parole violation in San Diego, and then he was transferred to Oklahoma City. That's a considerable distance. How unusual is that in itself?
I don't practice criminal law, although I still laugh at it. Some people say it's a crime. I'm a lawyer, but I now know. At the time, it didn't seem unusual because I knew nothing about criminal law. I now know that it should not have happened. The crime he committed was in Southern California, the robbery. His probation officer was in Southern California. The judge who sentenced him was in Southern California. He should have been brought back in front of the judge who had sentenced him, and they would have had a hearing on whether or not he had violated his parole. He shouldn't have been sent to Oklahoma, and there was no way that the judge in Oklahoma could have handled that parole revocation hearing. So it shouldn't have happened. But at the time, it did not seem, there was nothing that struck me as unusual because I just simply didn't know the procedure in the criminal justice system. But what I did learn later, and it came about over the course of years, was about 6 months after it was December of 1995 or January of 1995, I received an anonymous phone call. And this was back before we had telephones that would show you who's calling and everything else, and computers were very primitive then, and cell phones were the size of bricks almost, if you recall, in the mid-1990s. But I received a phone call from this person who said, I want you to know that your brother was murdered by the FBI. It was a case of mistaken identity. He fit the profile of a group of people who are robbing banks to get money to attack the federal government, sort of a militia movement type operation. And I, of course, I remember the words. I said it was an interrogation that went wrong. And I just sort of dismissed it as a crank call from, and I got a lot of those at the time trying to find out what happened to my brother. And then about June or July of 1996, I see an article in the Los Angeles Times talking about a man named Richard Lee Guthrie, who had been found hanging in his cell in federal custody. And it was the day before Guthrie had said that he was going to give an interview to the Los Angeles Times that would blow the lid off the Oklahoma City bombing. And it just simply said that Guthrie belonged to a group of bank robbers. And I didn't focus much on Guthrie. There was no photograph of Guthrie either. And then shortly before his death, I received a message from Tim McVeigh, who told me, he said, when I saw your brother's picture, and heard what happened to him, I want you to know that, in my opinion, he was murdered by the FBI because they mistook him for Richard Lee Guthrie. And I looked at a photograph of Guthrie, and Guthrie looked very similar to my brother. But what really brought all the pieces together was a phone call from a reporter named J.D. Cash, who had followed the Oklahoma City bombing from the moment it happened. He was a reporter in eastern Oklahoma. He'd had family and friends killed in the bombing. And it was in 2003, I believe, or 2004, when I received a call from J.D., and he said, if you got a minute, I'd like to talk to you about your brother. And I said, sure. And what J.D. said was, describe your brother. And I said, well, you know, he was, and J.D. said, well, how tall was he? And I said, he's about 5'8", 5'9". J.D. said, what was his build like? I said, he was a very powerfully built man. Complexion, I said, he was dark complected. A mustache, yes, had a mustache. Where was he when he was picked up? And I said, well, he was coming back across the border from Mexico. He'd been down to visit some friends down there. And his wife's family, she's Mexican-American, a citizen in the United States, but still have family in Baja, California. And J.D. said, what was he driving? And I said, a mid-1980s, a 1986 Chevrolet pickup truck. And J.D. said, did he have any tattoos? And I said, yes. And J.D. said, what kind? And I said, he had a dragon tattoo. And J.D. said, where? And I said, on his left forearm. And J.D. said, oh, shit. He said, you better sit down. I said, I'm sitting down. And he said, let me tell you this. He said, the largest manhunt in American history was for John Doe 2. It was occurring at the time your brother was arrested. And J.D. said, this is the description of John Doe 2. White male, powerful upper body build, 5'8", 5'9", dark complected, believed to be in Canada or Mexico, driving mid-1980s Chevrolet pickup truck, dragon tattoo, left forearm. And that's when it all came together, that they had mistaken my brother for someone else. And now someone else was Richard Lee Guthrie, who was a perfect match, I found out later, for my brother, down to the dragon tattoo on his left forearm. As they said, Guthrie ended up hanging, supposedly suicide, in his cell while in the custody of the FBI. We had an eyewitness to my brother's murder, an inmate named Alden Gildas Baker. A month before we were going to go to the trial, Baker supposedly hangs himself in his cell while under FBI custody. Again, another suicide. And all of that.
So what year did this conversation take place again?
Which one?
The one with J.D. Cash.
About 2003, early 2000, 2004.
And did he say what prompted him at that time to come forward and ask you about your brother?
He had been suspicious all along about my brother's death, and he had followed the story in the paper about the missing evidence, the destruction of evidence. They had made two attempts, the federal government had, to indict me during this, trying to get to find out what happened to my brother. And he always thought that there was something there, and I don't know what prompted him other than that to call, but he did call, and we had that conversation.
They attempted to indict you.
Yes.
That's remarkable.
No, it's not. That's typically what the government does, I found out, to get rid of someone who is an irritant, and I was an irritant then. I'd like to think that I'm more than an irritant now.
So what kind of steps were you taking at the time to find out more about your brother?
I started, once after J.D.'s conversation, I started to file Freedom of Information Act requests for information linking Guthrie to the bombing, because then I would have it. I mean, if I had Guthrie, if I could prove that Guthrie was John Doe 2, then it was clearly the motive for the murder, the torture murder of my brother. And I would tell your audience, if you go look at that website on my brother, you'll be shocked. The pictures are gruesome. As to what was done to him, down to his cutting his throat. And he was strangled you'll see on the website, he was strangled with a pair of plastic handcuffs after he'd been beaten and tortured for information he didn't have. But I've been helped. And so what happened along the way by people I don't even know, and I had been leaked two teletypes from then FBI Director Louis Free to his field offices in Oklahoma, in I believe Omaha, and think Kansas City. There were several FBI field offices this memo had gone to. And it was an FBI informant reporting that 2 days before the bombing, Tim McVeigh had called this white supremacist compound in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City, asking for more help. And it had been reported to the FBI, and they hadn't stopped the bombing. I was leaked a sealed transcript from a federal court proceeding in which another informant was testifying that she had gone and scouted the target, the Murrow Building, with McVeigh and others, 4 months before the bombing had occurred. And if it was, they were going to blow up the Murrow Building. And the government never stopped it. So I filed Freedom of Information Act requests for documents, which it occurred to me that what we were dealing here with was a sting operation run by the FBI. I've since discovered that the FBI actually had an operation called PATCON, Patriot Conspiracy, and they used it to infiltrate the militia movement in this country. And suspecting that what had happened here was an effort to infiltrate the militia, to incite them to try to do something illegal and arrest them, I thought that was the plan the FBI had at this instance. And I thought that for a number of reasons, but not only from what I saw in terms of evidence, but from what had happened previously. The FBI had botched the Ruby Ridge situation. Waco was a disaster for them. They were having such pressure put upon them by the American people, the media, and Congress, that they needed something to save their face, to restore their image and their credibility. And what I think happened is they set up this PATCON operation. The objective was to incite some act of insurrection or violence by the militia movement against the federal government, to arrest the perpetrators or would-be perpetrators with cameras running and be heroes. And somewhere, somehow, it went wrong for them.
So to be clear, where does the information on PATCON come from, and is there anything in the public record?
There's nothing in the public record that I know of. It's all from the Freedom of Information Act materials that I've obtained. But that's a marvelous story in itself, because I had been leaked these documents. And I filed a Freedom of Information Act request saying I want all documents linking Richard Guthrie to the bombing, Tim McVeigh and others, and to this white supremacist compound in Oklahoma called Elohim City. Well, of course, the FBI comes back and says there are no such documents. So I sued to get them. And I had the documents. The FBI did not know that I had these two memos. The FBI also didn't know that I had an affidavit already from a retired FBI agent who said these memos were not frauds or fakes, they were real, and it came from the FBI director. And while the FBI is very powerful, it has one weakness that you can take advantage of. The Bureau, as they like to refer to themselves, will always lie, even when the truth serves them better. So I knew they would lie to the judge. And they did. They came back and said there are no documents. And so I produced those two documents. I knew they'd come back and say that there were frauds or fakes, which they did. And so I filed the affidavit from the retired agent. And the federal judge went ballistic on the FBI. And he ordered a manual search And he said, I want all documents showing a link between the FBI, the sting operation, Elohim City, and the destruction of the Murrow Building and the murders of 169 people. They immediately rush back and tell the judge that we can't do this, Your Honor. We have informants whose names will be disclosed. It could involve their lives if it gets out that they were involved in this. And the judge says, black out the names, turn over the documents. And they came back with something like 400 or 500 pages of documents dealing with this sting operation. But the earliest document was dated on the afternoon of April 19th, 1995, which was after the bomb went off that morning. And so I go back to the court and I say, Your Honor, this is ridiculous. There's no way this sting operation sprang suddenly to life 2 hours after the Murrow Building had been blown up. It had to have been in place prior to that time. And the judge agreed. And he said, what would you like to do? And I said, I would like to go take the deposition. Excuse me. I told the court I would like to take the deposition of Terry Nichols. I had already been able to get in to see, and I'll never know how I was able to do it, but to see Terry Nichols, and I had spent a day and a half with him. Nichols wanted to tell the truth about the bombing. He had been convicted in federal court, given a life sentence in federal court, but not the death sentence. And the jury essentially said, it's clear to us that there were other people involved, and we do not understand why the federal government's not going after him. So we're not going to give Terry Nichols the death penalty. Nichols was retried in state court in Oklahoma for murder. Same result. The jury came back guilty, but we're not going to give him the death penalty because it's clear to us that there were other people involved, and we don't understand why the state of Oklahoma or the federal government have not pursued them. Well, after this happened, Nichols could not be retried. He could only be tried for the crimes in state court and federal court, and once he'd been tried and the verdicts were rendered, they couldn't try him again. So Nichols writes to then Attorney General Ashcroft, and he tells the Attorney General, come and see me, and I'll tell you all about the bombing. I'll tell you who was involved. I'll even tell you the government informants who were involved, and I'll lay it all out for you. Now, you would think if you're the Attorney General of the United States, even if you don't think Terry Nichols is going to be truthful, you would at least want to know what goes through the mind of somebody who does something like this, who has this kind of animosity towards the government. But not only does Ashcroft not go see Nichols or send anyone to see Nichols, he issues an order that the media is to have no contact with Terry Nichols. So here I have an order from a federal judge saying, you go take Nichols' deposition and do it on videotape. Well, the FBI immediately ran to the Court of Appeals and had that order set aside. And you have to wonder why. Why would the FBI be so concerned about Terry Nichols telling the truth about the Oklahoma City bombing?
And as I understand, Congressman Rohrabacher had been part of a committee that had been investigating possible foreign connections to the OKC bombing, and he had talked to Terry Nichols, but Terry Nichols had declined to talk to him a second time?
What happened is the federal government would not allow Congressman Rohrabacher to meet alone with Nichols. The FBI had agents present in the room.
And which kind of defeats the purpose, I suppose.
It certainly defeats the purpose. Because Nichols had told me that the detonators used in the bombing had come from a person who was working for the FBI. So there was no... I mean, Nichols, as he told me, he did not feel free to talk when you have FBI agents standing there in the room. When you specifically ask, and the congressman asks, to meet alone with him. And Rohrabacher eventually issued a report. It was a scathing report about the FBI. He had tried to subpoena records. He'd asked for access to witnesses, And they literally told him to go pound sand. They weren't going to honor his subpoenas. They weren't going to give him anything. And, of course, there was not enough support on his committee to back up his subpoenas. And it all comes down to politics. I mean, whichever party it was did not want that story out there, so they're not going to back up the congressman's effort to get subpoenas honored that had been served upon the FBI. But it was a horrible situation when the FBI looks at a subpoena from a congressional committee and says, shove it. We're not going to obey this. We're not going to give you access to people who have knowledge about the Oklahoma City bombing. We're not going to give you any records.
So then how many times did you meet with Terry Nichols, and how many depositions did you take?
I took no depositions because the federal court, the FBI went to a higher court and got an order setting it aside, the order that I had allowing me to take the deposition. And so I spent a day and a half with him, was never able to take his deposition, which is, as I said, the only thing he wanted to do was to tell what happened in the Oklahoma City bombing, and more importantly, the others involved, to identify them. And the government has fought me for years to keep that from happening.
But you have managed to get some of the information that Terry Nichols told you out to the public.
I have, and I've gotten some of the documents through FOIA requests that are incredible documents. It was not only this operation, this paramilitary white supremacist compound in eastern Oklahoma known as Elohim City. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, had informants there. The FBI had informants. The Secret Service was there. I found out later the CIA was there. As far as I can tell, just about every federal agency was there except the IRS. And they had informants with Tim McVeigh, planted with him, and the people who helped him in the bombing. They knew well in advance of April 19, 1995, that the bombing was going to take place, and they never stopped it. And what I've never worked out in my mind is whether it got away from the government, that they intended to stop the bombing, or whether they wanted it to happen. That I don't know. But they clearly knew it was going to take place. They were told months before and did nothing to prevent it.
Well, you mentioned the phone call that... Sorry, I was going to mention that you mentioned earlier the phone call that Timothy McVeigh made to Elohim City 2 days before, and from my understanding, that was an attempt to get help with the bombing from somebody at the compound. Where does that information come from?
It comes from an FBI document, a teletype from FBI Director Louis Free to the field office in Oklahoma City, I think it was Kansas City, and in Omaha, that McVeigh had called Elohim City 2 days before the bombing, asking for more help.
But we don't know specifically who he was calling at that time.
I don't know who he was calling. But so whoever he was calling certainly was working for the government, or else someone standing there was working for the government because they reported the phone call.
Well, tell us about Andreas Strassmeier and his role.
Strassmeier was a German national. He was illegally in the United States. He was a former German intelligence officer. He was the explosives and weapons training person at Elohim City. He leaves Elohim City immediately after the bombing, and he is taken out of the country by the CIA. They take him out through Mexico and then back to Germany. And interestingly, in all my years of fighting these Freedom of Information Act requests, battles with the federal government, in only one instance has the government asserted national security. as an exemption. Their national security is a trump card when you in a FOIA request. Once that's asserted, the judge is shut down and they can't turn over the documents. It turned out that the CIA had the spy satellite systems over Elohim City. Why in the world they would do that, I don't know. And I asked for the records on that, and it came back, and the response was, to release this information, these documents would pose a grave threat to the national security of the United States of America. And that's the only instance. The FBI has done everything but assert national security when they fight me for these documents. The same is true of the other agencies, but the CIA played the national security card right up front. And the CIA is not supposed to be involved in domestic intelligence. It is a foreign intelligence service, and it's illegal for the CIA to have operations within the United States.
That's absolutely true, but I suppose if they just continue to assert national security, then no one can ever really get to the bottom of their operations within the country. But it's certainly the connection to Strassmeyer is particularly interesting, and I believe the official version of events states that Strassmeyer was not acquainted with McVeigh, or only briefly acquainted with him?
Only briefly acquainted with him. And yet, Nichols said that Strassmeyer had told McVeigh that Elohim City would be a safe house for them after the bombing.
Well, tell us about the bank robbing syndicate that McVeigh was involved with, that was somehow perhaps being used to come up with funding for this bombing. Tell us about that and how this ties into the case.
Well, Richard Guthrie was one of the leaders of a group called the Midwest Bank Robbers. And they would rob banks in the Midwest and use the money funneling it into Elohim City and other places. They literally were insurrectionists, and they wanted to cause an uprising in this country against the federal government. Their plan was to attack the federal government, to blow up federal buildings, to kill federal officials, to incite race riots. They were racist neo-Nazis, and McVeigh robbed banks with them. In fact, he was the getaway driver. Drove the getaway cars for them on a number of bank robberies. And as I said, Guthrie was apprehended, and just before he was to give a tell-all interview with the Los Angeles Times that would blow the lid off the Oklahoma bombing story, he supposedly hangs himself while in FBI custody. And this man was a former Navy SEAL. They're not typically, I don't think, those are the kind of people who go out and kill themselves.
One would assume not, no. And, all right, well, there are so many different aspects to this case that we've already, I mean, already starting to gloss over some of them. So let's go back and look at some of the different ways in which the government had foreknowledge of what was coming at the OKC bombing. And you mentioned that there was an informant who knew, who actually went to case out the Alfred P. Murrah building before the bombing took place. Tell us a little bit more about that story.
That informant was Carol Howe. She had gone with Strassmeyer and others from Elohim City to case a number of federal buildings in Oklahoma City. And this was in October of 1994 as a potential bombing target. This testimony came about in a trial or hearing in federal court in Oklahoma. Is taking place while the McVeigh trial, federal trial for murder, is taking place in Denver, Colorado. The United States attorney in the proceeding in Oklahoma jumps up and says, "My God, Your Honor, if this gets out, it's going to cause all kinds of problems." And the judge and the U.S. attorney says, "You know, if it gets out that the federal government knew that these folks in Elohim City were planning to blow up a federal building in Oklahoma City, while that McVeigh trial is going on, it is going to cause us all kinds of problems." So the judge ordered the transcript sealed. And I was leaked a copy of that, and I put it out to the world. And I, for my own preservation and to get the word out and the knowledge out about what had happened, I made an effort that the moment I receive a document or any information, I put it out to the media, to everybody in the world who wants it.
And absolutely, and let's just stop there for a moment, because I think some people might not appreciate just how important that is, but obviously, as has been proven time and again in the case of your brother and many other people involved with this case, there have been people who have been murdered or accidentally murdered or what have you because of their relation to this case, and it's absolutely vital that people who have information like this do get it out and out into the public as soon as possible for their own protection at any rate.
I had a former federal person tell me that anyone can commit a murder. It takes an expert to commit a suicide. So I took that to heart. And that's one of the reasons I make sure that everything I can that I receive, I put out there. And amazingly, the media, the mainstream media, has asked for this material, but they won't touch this story. And I've been essentially told by them that this story is so ugly, we want to be second. We're not going to walk out on that plank first. We're going to let somebody else break it. Then we'll jump on it, but it's not coming from us first. And the only people who actually do the story and run it in the mainstream was the BBC. And, of course, that story never made it to the United States. It aired and was in Europe, but not here.
Tell us a little bit about that and how it came about.
It came about because of the documents, and I received a call from a BBC producer who said, can I have the documents? And I said, certainly. And then they, a week or two later, said, can we come over and talk to you? And I said, of course. They came over, spent a couple of days with me, and then they went to Oklahoma City and filmed for 30 days. Went to Oklahoma and filmed a documentary on the bombing and the federal government's involvement. And it aired in Europe, but not here.
And what information did they include in that documentary?
All of the stuff about Strassmeyer and the documents I had found, the documents that talked in terms of the prior knowledge the government had about the plan to blow up the Murrow Building, the fact that they had so many informants involved with McVeigh. It's been years since I've looked at it, but basically it was to lay out this was a sting operation that went south. And once that happened, the federal government pulled out all the stops in order to try to cover this thing up. And it's that old adage, first comes the screw-up, then comes the cover-up. I mean, that's what happened here, assuming it was a screw-up.
Well, that is the question. And yet, of course, absolutely no American mainstream media wants to touch this story with a 10-foot pole, and I think that'll come as no surprise to my listeners. All right, well, so going back to the issue of foreknowledge, we have Carol Howe, the FBI informant who cased out the Alfred P. Murrah Building with the Elohim City gang in October of 94. And I understand that Terry Nichols also told you about a phone call that was apparently placed a day or 2 days before the bombing, warning the FBI that there was a bombing going to take place.
Yes, and I found an FBI document that confirmed what I'm about to tell your listeners happened. Nichols is in Oklahoma awaiting trial for murder on the state charges. He'd already been convicted but not given the death penalty by a federal jury. He's approached by a person who claims to be an off-the-books operative of the Department of Justice and is taken in to see Nichols, and it says, my name will not appear on any records or anything, so it'll be complete deniability on the part of the federal government. But we can assure you will not receive the death penalty if you'll agree to three things. And Nichols says, well, how can you promise me that I won't receive the death penalty here in Oklahoma? And this operative said, we will not provide witnesses or evidence to the state prosecutors so that they won't be able to convict you. And what did, and Nichols says, then what are the three things they have to do? And the first thing they said is, you have to take responsibility. Well, first of all, they said, Nichols says, one of the three things I have to do. And the first thing they say is, you have to implicate your brother in the bombing. And Nichols says, I won't do that. My brother wasn't involved. And they said, the second thing, what's the second thing? And they said, you have to take responsibility or credit for a phone call that was made to us, the FBI, April 18th, 1995, warning about the bombing. And Nichols said, I didn't make that call. And they said, it doesn't matter. You just say you did. And what that told me was somewhere there is a record of that phone call having been made that the FBI cannot get rid of. And so they need someone who will take credit for it in the event it eventually is discovered, that record. And Nichols, and that was no problem for Nichols. I mean, he would have taken credit for that, I'm assuming. He never told me he would, but to save his life, that's just common sense. And Nichols said, what's the third thing? And they said, we want to know where the detonators that you took from the home of Roger Moore in Arkansas are buried. And Nichols thought they wanted those detonators to implicate Moore in the bombing. And Nichols says, I will give you Roger Moore. And supposedly the person says to Nichols, no deal. Moore's untouchable. So that told me what they wanted then were those detonators, because they would have the fingerprints of the other people involved in the bombing, one or more of whom would have been the fingerprints of an informant. And eventually the FBI finds those detonators and destroys them. And the purpose of that was, as I said, the purpose in my mind, the purpose of looking for those detonators, again, on the part of the FBI, I think, was to get them, to destroy them before the fingerprints could be taken off of them, so that there'd be no way that anyone in the future would link any of their informants to the bombing.
I don't quite get that part of it, because I don't understand, if these were unused detonators, then whose fingerprints would have been on them?
They were also the detonators that had been used to detonate the bomb. Part of them had been used to detonate the Murrah Building bombing.
I see. So these were some of the leftovers.
Leftovers.
Right. I see. So that whoever was involved in constructing the bomb would have been, their prints would have been on there as well.
Yes. And that's exactly what happened. Nichols tried to get Homeland Security. He tried to leak the location of these detonators to a number of people other than the FBI. The FBI found out about them, immediately rushes in, seizes them, and destroys them.
And when was that? When did that take place?
They destroyed them. April of 2005 is when they found them, and I think they were destroyed shortly thereafter.
Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. And so there again, there's direct proof that there was a phone call that the FBI, I guess, is trying to get rid of the trace of that, or get rid of the responsibility for that phone call.
Yes.
Absolutely incredible. All right. Well, I guess before we move on from Terry Nichols, was there any other information that Nichols had conveyed to you that you want to give to the listeners?
He suspected I don't know if it's true or not. He suspected that McVeigh was a government operative. Now, whether he started out as such and went rogue, I don't know. I do know that McVeigh was at Waco and apparently just went ballistic at what happened there. But prior to that time, he was traveling the militia circuit all around the country, staying with the various militia movements and then moving on to another and another and another. He fit the pattern of a government operative. But whether he was or not, I don't know. But Nichols suspected that he was.
That's right. And there was a letter that McVeigh wrote to his sister in which he conveyed the idea that he was part of a special operations team. that was printed in the New York Times, I believe. So you mentioned the Roger Moore incident. Perhaps you can tell the listeners a little bit about what that was and how Nichols was involved in that.
Nichols had robbed Roger Moore's home in Arkansas. And there, I mean, he said that some people said he didn't do it. He said he did. I know that he had possessions of the firearms and other materials, other items taken out of Moore's home. The story, at least what Nichols has put in the public record in the federal court, was it was to provide an excuse to Moore in the event that somehow later on was to be linked to McVeigh and Nichols, that they could say that was because of the items taken from the home or something like that. And more or less to give an alibi to Moore.
Right, and so to flesh this out for people who don't know who Roger Moore is, this is someone that McVeigh had met along the militia gun show circuit?
Yes, and traveled with him.
And stayed at his ranch, I believe.
Yes, in Arkansas. Well, apparently a frequent visitor.
And it was McVeigh who put Nichols up to the task of robbing him, supposedly specifically because he had never met Nichols before.
That's true. That's what Nichols, I say that's what Nichols says, and it's said in court.
And again, that was supposedly to get rid of the trace. Roger Moore was apparently in on it, or at least that's the story, and it was just to get rid of the trace of Moore, or so that he couldn't be directly connected if anything traced back to him after the bombing.
As I understand, as Nichols explained in the court documents, it was to say that if his fingerprints turned up on anything or other forensic evidence came up, it would be because that had been on the items that had been taken from Moore's home.
All right, well, okay, let's move on to another incredibly important part of this case that you've been extremely diligent in getting information out on, and one that I've talked about before and I think is absolutely central to this case, and that's the issue of the surveillance cameras. And as people may know, you were the one that was responsible for filing a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI that resulted in the release of 26, I believe, surveillance tapes from around the Alfred P. Murrah building on April 19th, 1995. But perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about that case and how it developed.
Well, I was leaked a government document that said surveillance cameras show the truck bomb detonating 3 minutes and 6 seconds after the suspects exited the vehicle. Now, that's significant for a whole bunch of reasons. First, they had cameras that actually showed the truck being driven up to the Murrah Building Park and the people getting out. Well, the FBI says, you know, there was only one person in that truck, and that was Tim McVeigh. Well, there was more than one person in that truck, and the other person was probably an informant. You would think that tape would have been Exhibit 1 in the McVeigh murder trial. No one's ever seen it but the government. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and I asked for this. I said, I want the surveillance tapes from the exterior cameras on these buildings leading on the route leading up to the Murrah Building. So the route McVeigh took that morning, these tapes were shown in that truck and who was in it with him. And I said, I also want the surveillance tapes from the Alfred P. Murrah building. There were two cameras on the outside of that building. They would have clearly shown who was with McVeigh in that truck. Well, the FBI produces 26 tapes from the other buildings, not the Murrah building. And these tapes, at strategic moments, go blank. And not all at the same time, but it's, you know, the building furthest away goes blank for a few seconds. The tape does. The tape from the next building goes blank a little while afterwards for a few seconds, and so on, leading up to the Murrah Building. So that the moment that truck was being driven by, these tapes mysteriously go blank. And the FBI says, well, that's because the tapes were being recycled or changed, or that was, I think that was their excuse. all 26 tapes were being changed or recycled literally within about a three-minute period between 8:58 and 9:02 on the morning of April 19th, 1995. But they don't give me the Murrow Building tapes. And so I go to court to get the Murrow Building tapes, and there will be a hearing in federal court here in Salt Lake City on May 11th, 2011, over those tapes. And the FBI's response has been to the court that we've looked real, real hard, Your Honor, but by God, we can't find those tapes.
Let's stop there to clarify a couple of points. You said there were 26 surveillance tapes that were released to you.
Yes.
And every single one of those had at least some missing time between the 8:50 and 9:05 in that period prior to the bombing.
The tapes that would have shown the route. Now, a lot of them weren't. Some of them weren't. They gave me interior shots and stuff like that. Those were complete. The exterior cameras dealing with the route go blank.
Okay, so it was the one specifically that would have shown the approach of the truck. So none of them actually show anything whatsoever of the approach of the truck.
That's correct.
And regarding the Murrah Building cameras themselves, I have read that they actually were being stored, the footage was being stored off-site. It wasn't actually tape in cameras on the building. But I have no source to back that up. I don't have any confirmation of that. Is that your understanding, or is there actually tapes that were secured from the building that day?
It's more than my understanding. I obtained two declarations, which is like an affidavit used in federal court. One was from an Oklahoma City police officer who had been on the, I guess it's a special detail that provides security to federal officials who come to Oklahoma. And as part of his responsibilities in that job, he had been taken through the Murrow Building, shown the cameras, shown the recording systems off-site. They were recorded off-site. And he was also on scene immediately after the bombing, digging through the rubble, trying to save people, when he said, almost at gunpoint, the FBI forces them out of the building, and he watches the FBI take down the cameras off the building. I mean, they put... It was more important to them to seize those cameras than to save victims in the rubble. More important to the FBI. And he sat there and watched as they took those cameras down, and then they let them back in to do their rescue operation. The other affidavit I had was from a man who actually knew the system. What the camera showed, where the tape decks, the recording decks were located, and they were located two or three blocks away in another federal building. That's where the recordings took place. So yes, those tapes exist. Those tapes were never damaged.
So if the footage is being stored off-site, then what is the point of taking the cameras down off the building unless it's to obscure the fact that there were cameras on the building itself?
It's to obscure the fact there were cameras on the building.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. But surely no one could think that they would be able to cover that up. Obviously, there would be people who would know about that system and would know about the existence of those cameras.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you seen the photographs of my brother, the body?
Yes, I have. Unfortunately, it's quite horrific, but yes.
Would you think anyone could cover that up as a suicidal hanging?
It does boggle the imagination to think that anyone would be led to believe that, and it certainly... After hearing that there was two attempts to cremate the body, I certainly understand why.
Well, they've succeeded in covering that up. My brother's murder is a suicidal hang.
Unfortunately, very true.
Part of the reason they get away with it is there's no investigative media anymore. The First Amendment, the press has fallen far short of what the Founding Fathers perceived its role in our government. If you think back to you may not be old enough, to the Watergate instance, when the press was dogged and investigated. And that press in those days did exactly what the Founding Fathers thought, and that was to, wanted them to do is to monitor the government, to report on what the government was doing. That doesn't happen anymore. And in fact, one of the documents that came out recently that there's been some press on is the FBI has a program of planting moles in the major media outlets. Informants. And it's much like the CIA did years ago when they would plant someone in our government and wait for 20 or 30 years until they rose to a position of power and influence with access to confidential information and an ability to direct policy or government action. So that has come out here within the last 3 weeks, that they had moles in these major media outlets, and you have to only assume that it was for two purposes. One is to obtain information about what, for example, you know, lots of times the press will write a story about the government, and you know, I have a confidential source. It's to find out who that source was, and also to direct stories or to kill stories that are embarrassing to the government.
Indeed, well, that will tie in to the reports of CIA's Operation Mockingbird and the repeated times in which the U.S. military has admitted that military psychological operations officers have been staffing various locations, including CNN's headquarters. So once again, there's multiple agencies infesting the mainstream media organs, and that's certainly one of the reasons why things like your brother's death do not get reported on. And that brings to mind the question regarding J.D. Cash, who you mentioned earlier. Is he still alive? Is he still working on this case?
No, J.D. died about 3 years ago.
I see, yes. I have read some of his reports, but I wasn't aware of it.
J.D. figured this out early on. I've stood on the shoulders of a giant, J.D. Cash. I mean, J.D., it was a pleasure to work with J.D. for a few years. But J.D. figured it out right away that the government had prior knowledge. They had informants. And he, like myself, could never reach a conclusion as to whether it was just the sting operation got away from the FBI or whether they actually wanted it to happen. Because people say, why would they want it to happen? Well, they always benefit. They increase funding. You have the Patriot Act and all the other surveillance. The American people lose a number of their rights whenever one of these incidents happen. And we seem willing to give up those rights for what we think will be security in the future.
Absolutely, and that's unfortunately very true. And again, that was very much the case with the OKC bombing. And there is speculation of the files that were contained in the FBI offices in the building. There's speculation about a number of things related to the case and why the building itself was blown up so quickly afterwards, and all sorts of very unusual circumstances around the bombing itself. But getting back, I think we got a little bit off track from the question of the videotapes, and that brings up a report that was just released on April 10th from biggovernment.com, Oklahoma City bombing videotapes, subject of federal court hearing in Salt Lake City, May 11th. And this talks about a hearing that's going to take place with Judge Clark Wadups, presiding in the U.S. District. Wadups, presiding in the U.S. District Court for the District of Utah Central Division, and it comes some 3.5 years after Utah Attorney Jesse Trenadue used FOIA to request the FBI to turn over copies of surveillance video captured April 19th, 1995, etc., etc. Perhaps you can tell us about this hearing and what it's going to decide.
The hearing is over the mirror building tapes. It's a very significant case for a number of reasons. Obviously, the tapes. I mean, if I get access to the tapes and it'll immediately go public, it'll show who carried out the attack on the Murrow Building and who else was involved. But more important than that, it goes to the core of what is the government's responsibility under the Freedom of Information Act of FOIA. The FBI's position, and it's the position they assert all over this country, that when someone asks for a document or a record that is potentially harmful to the Bureau, the response is, we looked for it and we can't find it. Their position is, all the law requires is for them to look. It does not require them to find and produce a record. And why this is significant in this case is, the tapes exist. So it's not a case where they can say, we don't know if there is a record or not. In this case, there are tapes. The second reason it's significant is, in other instances, they've been able to assert a privilege from production. National security, an ongoing criminal investigation. There's a number of exemptions under FOIA that says you can't get records if they fall into these documents that are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. They don't have that claim here. So we have the documents in existence. We don't have any privilege that protects them, the documents being the tapes or the records. No privilege that protects them. And the issue comes down to, is that all the law requires is that the FBI look and report back to a judge that we can't find anything? And my position is that can't be the law, because the purpose of the Freedom of Information Act was to give the public access to what the government was doing. And this would eviscerate FOIA if all they had to do was say, we looked and wink, nod, we can't find anything. So my position is, once you know it exists and there's no privilege, you sure as hell have to find it and turn it over.
So I assume that currently they're trying to hold that they're not even obligated to talk about what that search involved or what types of records or in what way they were searching.
Oh, they said they did a computer search and they just can't find it. Well, I've seen in the past, and one of the documents I filed in support of my motion was from a retired FBI agent that said in the Oklahoma bombing case, they had what were called zero files. And this was evidence no one was to see. It goes into the zero file. I also found out in the course of my FOIA request, and this has become rather significant publicly, I happened across what the FBI calls iDrives. In a FOIA response or request, and in a criminal case, the FBI turns over in a FOIA case, they would search the official file for documents. It's the official file they turn over to the defense counsel in a criminal case. The iDrive is where evidence goes before it goes into the official file. And then the FBI makes a determination whether to put it in the official file or leave it in the iDrive where it's never recorded, never reported. And, of course, they tell me only irrelevant evidence remains in the iDrive. All relevant evidence goes to the official file that's turned over to defense counsel and made available to the public on FOIA request. Well, I don't for a moment believe them on that. I think what goes into the iDrive is the evidence that would acquit somebody or that's embarrassing to the government.
Absolutely. Well, I hate to be defeatist about this, but given the way that vital information and documentation about your brother's death has been systematically erased and destroyed, could you imagine that the incriminating videotape would ever actually be turned over by the FBI?
It'll never be turned over. Can you imagine what it would do? It would go right to the highest levels of government in 1995. It would go right into the White House. That level of cover-up, that level of, and I'm not a politically motivated person. I could care less about either party. But it would be devastating. And if you look now, the very people who were involved in keeping a lid on the Oklahoma City bombing are back in power. You know, Eric Holder was the second in command under Janet Reno. In fact, Holder led the cover-up of my brother's murder. There's a whole bunch of emails back and forth where they refer to it as the Trinity mission. They liken it to the invasion, coordinating the invasion of Normandy to keep any investigations from going forward. I mean, it's named the Trinity mission. And they refer to in it as Trinidos and Trinidones, meaning things to do and things not to do in keeping the lids on this. And this is, he was then Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder, was heading that up. And you have to ask yourself, why would the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America be involved in the death of an inmate? Well, the reason now is simple, because that death goes right into the Oklahoma City bombing, which goes right back to the highest levels of the executive branch.
Absolutely. Well, tell us more about that. That's another extremely important part of this case that we haven't even really touched on yet. But tell us about Eric Holder and what was he coordinating there, and who was he corresponding with?
He was with the key leaders in the Senate to keep the Senate from holding hearings into my brother's murder and the disappearance of all the evidence, the perjury. The Inspector General of the United States did an investigation of my brother's death, then sealed the report. It's my understanding that it's the only Inspector General's report not involving national security that's ever been sealed. And you say you investigate Inspector General of the United States with one to investigate an inmate's death is incredible, but then to seal that report, and the objective was to keep Congress from holding hearings. And so Holder was the lead guy to get to the Hill. He dealt with Hatch. He dealt with Senator Dorgan, a Democrat, Republican, high up in their respective parties. It was to kill any judiciary inquiry, Senate Judiciary Committee inquiry into my brother's death. And he did it. And these emails, they talk about his contacts with Dorgan, his contacts with Hatch. It says the Hill takes precedent over everything. We've got to get out to them first. We've got to keep basically the Trinity mission. Our rollout plan is to get there first and kill this.
Absolutely.
The thing your audience has to understand, it's not me making this up. These come out of government documents. Everything I've told you is out of a government document. I didn't pull it out of my rear end.
You certainly didn't. And again, for those people who might not have been paying attention, we're talking about Eric Holder, the current Attorney General of the United States. And it's absolutely just incredible to think that this was going on in the case of as you say, an inmate's death, which under normal circumstances would not be receiving this type of attention.
Could never. Would never receive any attention.
Well, I think the conclusion that your brother was murdered and it was related to Richard Lee Guthrie and the OKC bombing is a completely overwhelming. There's no way to draw any other conclusion from this. But it does raise the question of where do we go from here? Obviously, you're continuing to fight to get information out from the FBI and from other sources, but what other avenues are you exploring in trying to find more leads on this case?
Well, first of all, my family will never get justice for my brother's murder. That'll never happen. The government will never prosecute anybody because it runs the risk of the minute it prosecutes somebody, the whole story, ugly story erupting. But what I can do, and there's no noble. I mean, I didn't start out to solve the Oklahoma City bombing. I started out to find out what happened to my brother, and every lead took me to the bombing. But back on the point of justice and why I do this, I do it for no other reason than to, I guess, embarrass the government. It is the only justice we'll get is to humiliate and expose the federal government for the corrupt entity that it apparently has become, especially the FBI. There's nothing noble in that, and I don't want your audience to think that there's anything noble in me. I was a hillbilly. If people know Southern Mountain people, their culture is when you kill one of us, you better kill us all back to third cousins, because sooner or later, if you leave one of us alive, we're going to get you. And I'll get them. I'll never get justice. But I'll sure as hell hurt them. I'll hurt their reputations. I'll hurt their image. And I like to think I've done that now. And at least there's some indication I've done it. Some of them, when I deal with the federal government, it's never the local U.S. attorneys anymore. They brought out the U.S. attorneys I deal with that brought out the main justice of Washington, D.C., and as a humorous aside, one they referred to me as Jesse Bin Laden. And I said, I didn't think that was fair, because I said, there's no way that son of a bitch hates you more than I do.
Well, what better way to put it? Well, I think you're right. I think we've been force-fed a false image of what a hero is from Hollywood and all sorts of media sources, that a hero is somehow someone who's on a podium doing some sort of incredibly noble mission. But I think in real life, heroes are people who are just ordinary people who have been thrust into incredible circumstances and are simply doing what they have to do. And by that definition, there's no doubt that what you're doing is heroic, and people need to support you and your ongoing quest to, if not secure justice for your brother's death, at least to help to bring to light what really did take place. So before we wrap this up, are there any other points that we haven't touched on yet that you'd like to get across for the listeners?
Oh, there's going to be much more come out of this. I've received a dump of about 300 pages of documents. It'll take me a while to get through them. And one of the documents that I came across and got out there was the mold document, that they had planted molds, the FBI had planted molds in the media.
And where can people go to get that document?
Josh, if you got a website, I'll send it to you.
Please do. I will put it up with the documentation for this interview.
I will just attach it to an email and send it back to you.
Excellent.
And I will also send you an incredible debriefing memo that takes place April 21st, 1995, when they're debriefing, the FBI and ATF are debriefing one of their informants who's explaining it, who had told them who had done the attack, why it was done. And please put that up too.
I certainly will. You've just said that you have 300 pages of documents? 300
thousand.
Documents.
1,000 pages.
3,000 or 300,000?
300,000.
That's incredible. That's mind-boggling. And as I know I don't have to tell you this, but obviously if there is any information in there that needs to get out right now, you need to do that before there's a chance to silence you on this issue.
Well, I've made copies and scattered them around, so. But I will send you some hot. I will send you some crew. I will send you these things for your audience. I will send you the mole memo. I will send you the debriefing memo. I will send you the sealed transcript, and I will send you a packet called Hot Documents, and it literally lays out who was involved, and these are all FBI or documents, and I'll send you the timeline on the Murrah Building tape. Again, all federal materials.
Absolutely incredible. And of course, those will be available on the website in the interviews tab along with this interview. So people who are listening can go and download them. And I urge people to do that, because the farther these things disseminate, I guess there's no putting the toothpaste back in the tube at that point. All right, absolutely incredible. Well, we've gone over an incredible amount of information, and you've been incredibly generous with your time so far. So I'd like to thank you for all of this this information that you're sharing and continuing to share. And I would also like to, of course, direct listeners to KennethTrenadue.com, where they can find out more about your brother, his death, and find some links to various articles that have been written about it. And I absolutely hope that we can certainly have you back on the program again in the future, especially after you've had the hearing about the Alfred P. Murrah Building tapes on May 11th. So I certainly hope that you can continue to keep us informed about what's happening in this case.
I would love to.
Excellent.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time, and absolutely, on behalf of myself and all my listeners, my deepest condolences for what happened to your brother, and myself, and I'm sure many of my listeners will help to spread the word about what really happened. And together we will start to raise awareness of these issues.
Please do, and I'll send you the Holder documents too.
Excellent. All right. Well, on that note, let's wrap up the conversation there, and promise to meet again in the future. So, Jesse Trenadue, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir.